Chapter 5. It is typical of Oxford, I said, to start the new year in autumn. Everywhere, on cobble and gravel and lawn, the leaves were falling, and in the college gardens the smoke of the bonfires joined the wet river mist, drifting across the grey walls. The flags were oily underfoot, and as, one by one, the lamps were lit in the windows round the quad, the golden lights were diffuse and remote. New figures in new gowns wandered through the twilight under the arches, and the familiar bells now spoke of a year's memories. The autumnal mood possessed us both as though the riotous exuberance of June had died with the gillyflowers, whose scent at my windows had now yielded to damp leaves, smouldering in a corner of the quad. It was the first Sunday evening of term. "I feel precisely 100 years old," said Sebastian. He had come up the night before, a day earlier than I, and this was our first meeting since we parted in the taxi. "I've had a talking to from Monsignor Bell this afternoon. That makes the fourth since I came up. My tutor, the junior dean, Mr. Samgrass of All Souls, and now Monsignor Bell."
"Who is Mr. Samgrass of All Souls?"
"Just someone of Mummy's. They all say that I made a very bad start last year, and that I have been noticed, and that if I don't mend my ways, I shall get sent down. How does one mend one's ways? I suppose one joins the League of Nations Union, and reads the Isis every week, and drinks coffee in the morning at the Cadena Cafe, and smokes a great pipe, and plays hockey, and goes out to tea on Boar's Hill, and to lectures at Keeble, and rides a bicycle with a little tray full of notebooks, and drinks cocoa in the evening, and discusses sex seriously. Oh, Charles, what has happened since last term? I feel so old."
"I feel middle-aged. That is infinitely worse. I believe we have had all the fun we can expect here."
We sat silent in the firelight as darkness fell.
"Anthony Blanche has gone down."
"Why?"
"He wrote to me. Apparently he's taken a flat in Munich. He has formed an attachment to a policeman there."
"I shall miss him."
"I suppose I shall, too, in a way."
We fell silent again, and sat so still in the firelight that a man who came in to see me stood for a moment in the door and then went away, thinking the room empty.
"This is no way to start a new year," said Sebastian. But this sombre October evening seemed to breathe its chill, moist air over the succeeding weeks. All that term and all that year, Sebastian and I lived more and more in the shadows, and, like a fetish, hidden first from the missionary and at length forgotten. The toy bear, Aloysius, sat unregarded on the chest of drawers in Sebastian's bedroom. There was a change in both of us. We had lost the sense of discovery which had infused the anarchy of our first year. I began to settle down. Unexpectedly, I missed my cousin Jasper, who had got his first in Greats and was now cumbrously setting about a life of public mischief in London. I needed him to shock. Without that massive presence, the college seemed to lack solidity. It no longer provoked and gave point to outrage as it had done in the summer. Moreover, I had come back glutted and a little chastened, with the resolve to go slow. Never again would I expose myself to my father's humour. His whimsical persecution had convinced me, as no rebuke could have done, of the folly of living beyond my means. I had had no talking to this term. My success in History Previous and a beta minus in one of my collections papers had put me on easy terms with my tutor, which I managed to maintain without undue effort. I kept a tenuous connection with the history school, wrote my two essays a week, and attended an occasional lecture. Besides this, I started my second year by joining the Ruskin School of Art. Two or three mornings a week we met, about a dozen of us, half at least the daughters of North Oxford, among the casts from the antique at the Ashmolean Museum. Twice a week we drew from the nude in a small room over a tea-shop. Some pains were taken by the authorities to exclude any hint of lubricity on these evenings, and the young women who sat for us were brought from London for the day and not allowed to reside in the university city. One flank, that nearer the oil-stove, I remember, was always rosy, and the other mottled and puckered as though it had been plucked. There, in the smell of the oil-lamp, we sat astride the donkey stools and evoked a barely visible wraith of Trilby. My drawings were worthless. In my own rooms I designed elaborate little pastiches, some of which, preserved by friends of the period, come to light occasionally to embarrass me. We were instructed by a man of about my age, who treated us with defensive hostility. He wore very dark blue shirts, a lemon-yellow tie, and horn-rimmed glasses.
and it was largely by reason of this warning that I modified my own style of dress until it approximated to what my cousin Jasper would have thought suitable for country house visiting. Thus, soberly dressed and happily employed, I became a fairly respectable member of my college. With Sebastian it was different. His year of anarchy had filled a deep interior need of his, the escape from reality, and as he found himself increasingly hemmed in, where once he felt himself free, he became at times listless and morose, even with me. We kept very much to our own company that term, each so much bound up in the other that we did not look elsewhere for friends. My cousin Jasper had told me that it was normal to spend one's second year shaking off the friends of one's first, and it happened as he said. Most of my friends were those I had made through Sebastian. Together we shed them and made no others. There was no renunciation. At first we seemed to see them as often as ever. We went to parties, but gave few of our own. I was not concerned to impress the new freshmen, who, like their London sisters, were here being launched in society. There were strange faces now at every party, and I, who a few months back had been voracious of new acquaintances, now felt surfeited. Even our small circle of intimates, so lively in the summer sunshine, seemed dimmed and muted now in the pervading fog, the river-born twilight that softened and obscured all that year for me. Anthony Blanche had taken something away with him when he went. He had locked a door and hung the key on his chain, and all his friends, among whom he had always been a stranger, needed him now. The charity matinee was over, I felt. The impresario had buttoned his astrakhan coat and taken his fee, and the disconsolate ladies of the company were without a leader. Without him, they forgot their cues and garbled their lines. They needed him to ring the curtain up at the right moment. They needed him to direct the limelights. They needed his whisper in the wings and his imperious eye on the leader of the band. Without him, there were no photographers from the weekly press, no prearranged goodwill and expectation of pleasure. No stronger bond held them together than common service. Now the gold lace and velvet were packed away and returned to the costumier, and the drab uniform of the day put on in its stead. For a few happy hours of rehearsal, for a few ecstatic minutes of performance, they had played splendid parts, their own great ancestors, the famous paintings they were thought to resemble. Now it was over, and in the bleak light of day they must go back to their homes, to the husband who came to London too often, to the lover who lost at cards, and to the child who grew too fast. Anthony Blanche's set broke up and became a bare dozen lethargic adolescent Englishmen. Sometimes in later life they would say, "Do you remember that extraordinary fellow we all used to know at Oxford, Anthony Blanche? I wonder what became of him." They lumbered back into the herd from which they had been so capriciously chosen, and grew less and less individually recognisable. The change was not so apparent to them as to us, and they still congregated on occasions in our rooms, but we gave up seeking them. Instead, we formed the taste for lower company, and spent our evenings, as often as not, in Hogarthian little inns in St. Ebbs and St. Clement's, and the streets between the old market and the canal, where we managed to be gay and were, I believe, well liked by the company. The Gardener's Arms and the Nag's Head, the Druid's Head near the theatre, and the Turf in Hell Passage knew us well. But in the last of these we were liable to meet other undergraduates, pub-crawling hearties from BNC, and Sebastian became possessed by a kind of phobia like that which sometimes comes over men in uniform against their own service, so that many an evening was spoilt by their intrusion, and he would leave his glass half empty and turn sulkily back to college. It was thus that Lady Marchmain found us when, early in that Michaelmas term, she came for a week to Oxford. She found Sebastian subdued, with all his host of friends reduced to one, myself. She accepted me as Sebastian's friend, and sought to make me hers also, and in doing so unwittingly struck at the roots of our friendship. That is the single reproach I have to set against her abundant kindness to me. Her business in Oxford was with Mr. Samgrass of All Souls, who now began to play an increasingly large part in our lives. Lady Marchmain was engaged in making a memorial book for circulation among her friends about her brother, Ned, the eldest of three legendary heroes, all killed between Mons and Passchendaele. He had left a quantity of papers, poems, letters, speeches, articles. To edit them, even for a restricted circle, needed tact and countless decisions in which the judgment of an adoring sister was liable to err. Acknowledging this, she had sought outside advice, and Mr. Samgrass had been found to help her. He was a young history don, a short, plump man, dapper in dress, with sparse hair brushed flat on an over-large head, neat hands, small feet, and the general appearance of being too often bathed. His manner was genial, and his speech idiosyncratic. We came to know him well. It was Mr. Sandgrass's particular aptitude to help others with their work, but he was himself the author of several stylish little books. He was a great delver in muniment rooms, and had a sharp nose for the picturesque. Sebastian spoke less than the truth when he described him as someone of mummies. He was someone of almost everyone's who possessed anything to attract him. Mr. Sandgrass was a genealogist and a legitimist. He loved dispossessed royalty and knew the exact validity of the rival claims of the pretenders to many thrones. He was not a man of religious habit, but he knew more than most Catholics about their church, and he had friends in the Vatican and could talk at length of policy and appointments, saying which contemporary ecclesiasts were in good favour, which in bad, what recent theological hypothesis was suspect, and how this or that Jesuit or Dominican had skated on thin ice or sailed near the wind in his Lenten discourses. He had everything except the faith, and later liked to attend benediction in the chapel of Brideshead, and see the ladies of the family with their necks arched in devotion under their black lace mantillas. He loved forgotten scandals in high life, and was an expert in putative parentage. He claimed to love the past, but I always felt that he thought all the splendid company, living or dead, with whom he associated, slightly absurd. It was Mr. Sandgrass who was real, the rest were an insubstantial pageant. He was the Victorian tourist, solid and patronising, for whose amusement these foreign things were paraded. And there was something a little too brisk about his literary manners. I suspected the existence of a dictaphone somewhere in his panelled rooms. He was with Lady Marchmain when I first met them, and I thought then that she could not have found a greater contrast to herself than this intellectual on the make, nor a better foil to her own charm. It was not her way to make a conspicuous entry into anyone's life. But towards the end of that week, Sebastian said rather sourly, "You and Mummy seem very thick." And I realised that, in fact, I was being drawn into intimacy by swift, imperceptible stages, for she was impatient of any human relationship that fell short of it. By the time that she left, I had promised to spend all next vacation, except Christmas itself, at Brideshead. One Monday morning, a week or two later, I was in Sebastian's room, waiting for him to return from a tutorial, when Julia walked in, followed by a large man whom she introduced as Mr. Mottram and addressed as Rex. They were motoring up from a house where they had spent the weekend, they explained. Rex Mottram was warm and confident in a check ulster. Julia, cold and rather shy in furs. She made straight for the fire and crouched over it, shivering. "We hoped Sebastian might give us luncheon," she said. "Failing him, we can always try Boy Mulcaster. But I somehow thought we should eat better with Sebastian, and we're very hungry. We've been literally starved all the weekend at the Chasms." "He and Sebastian are both lunching with me. Come too." So, without demur, they joined the party in my rooms, one of the last of the old kind that I gave. Rex Mottram exerted himself to make an impression. He was a handsome fellow, with dark hair growing low on his forehead and heavy black eyebrows. He spoke with an engaging Canadian accent. One quickly learned all that he wished one to know about him, that he was a lucky man with money, a member of Parliament, a gambler, a good fellow. That he played golf regularly with the Prince of Wales and was on easy terms with Max and F.E. and Gertie Lawrence and Augustus John and Carpentier, with anyone, it seemed, who happened to be mentioned. Of the university, he said, "No, I was never here. It just means you start life 3 years behind the other fellow." His life, so far as he made it known, began in the war, where he had got a good M.C. serving with the Canadians, and had ended as A.D.C. to a popular general. He cannot have been more than 30 at the time we met him, but he seemed very old to us in Oxford. Julia treated him, as she seemed to treat all the world, with mild disdain, but with an air of possession. During luncheon she sent him to the car for her cigarettes, and once or twice, when he was talking very big, she apologised for him, saying, "Remember, he's a colonial." To which he replied with boisterous laughter. When he had gone, I asked who he was. "Oh, just someone of Julia's," said Sebastian. We were slightly surprised a week later to get a telegram from him, asking us and Boy Mulcaster to dinner in London on the following night for a party of Julia's. "I don't think he knows anyone young," said Sebastian. "All his friends are leathery old sharks in the City and the House of Commons. Shall we go?" We discussed it, and because our life at Oxford was now so much in the shadows, we decided that we would. "Why does he want Boy?" "Julia and I have known him all our lives. I suppose, finding him at lunch with you, he thought he was a chum."
We had no great liking for Mulcaster, but the three of us were in high spirits when, having got leave for the night from our colleges, we drove off on the London Road in Hardcastle's car. We were to spend the night at Marchmain House. We went there to dress, and while we dressed, drank a bottle of champagne, going in and out of one another's rooms, which were together three floors up, and rather shabby compared with the splendours below. As we came downstairs, Julia passed us, going up to her room, still in her day clothes. "I'm going to be late," she said. "You boys had better go on to Rex's. It's heavenly of you to come." "What is this party?" "A ghastly charity ball I'm involved with. Rex insisted on giving a dinner party for it. See you there." Rex Mottram lived within walking distance of Marchmain House. "Julia's going to be late," we said. "She's only just gone up to dress." "That means an hour. We'd better have some wine." A woman who was introduced as Mrs. Champion said, "I'm sure she'd rather we started, Rex." "Well, let's have some wine first anyway." "Why a Jeroboam, Rex?" she said peevishly. "You always want to have everything too big."
"Won't be too big for us," he said, taking the bottle in his own hands and easing the cork.
There were two girls there, contemporaries of Julia's. They all seemed involved in the management of the ball. Mulcaster knew some them of old, and they, without much relish, I thought, knew him. Mrs. Champion talked to Rex. Sebastian and I found ourselves drinking alone together, as we always did. At length Julia arrived, unhurried, exquisite, unrepentant. "You shouldn't have let him wait," she said. "It's his Canadian courtesy." Rex Mottram was a liberal host, and by the end of dinner the three of us who had come from Oxford were rather drunk. While we were standing in the hall waiting for the girls to come down, and Rex and Mrs. Champion had drawn away from us, talking acrimoniously in low voices, Mulcaster said, "I say, let's slip away from this ghastly dance and go to Mar Mayfield's."
"Who is Mar Mayfield?"
"You know Mar Mayfield. Everyone knows Mar Mayfield of the Old Hundredth. I've got a regular there, a sweet little thing called Effie. There'd be the devil to pay if Effie heard I'd been to London and hadn't been in to see her. Come and meet Effie at Mar Mayfield's."
"All right," said Sebastian. "Let's meet Effie at Mar Mayfield's."
"We'll take another bottle of pop off the old good Mottram and then leave the bloody dance and go to the Old Hundredth. How about that?" It was not a difficult matter to leave the ball. The girls whom Rex Mottram had collected had many friends there, and after we had danced together once or twice, our table began to fill up. Rex Mottram ordered more and more wine. Presently, the three of us were together on the pavement.
"Do you know where this place is?"
"Of course I do. 100 Sink Street."
"Where's that?"
"Just off Leicester Square. Better take the car."
"Why?"
"Always better to have one's own car on an occasion like this."
We did not question this reasoning, and there lay our mistake. The car was in the forecourt of Marchmain House, within 100 yards of the hotel where we had been dancing. Mulcaster drove, and after some wandering, brought us safely to Sink Street. A commissionaire at one side of a dark doorway, and a middle-aged man in evening dress on the other side of it, standing with his face to the wall, cooling his forehead on the bricks, indicated our destination.
"Keep out, you'll be poisoned," said the middle-aged man.
"Members," said the commissionaire.
"The name is Mulcaster," said Mulcaster.
"Viscount Mulcaster."
"Well, try inside," said the commissionaire. "You'll be robbed, poisoned, and infected and robbed," said the middle-aged man.
Inside the dark doorway was a bright hatch. "Members?" asked a stout woman in evening dress.
"I like that," said Mulcaster. "You ought to know me by now."
"Yes, dearie," said the woman without interest. 10 bob each."
"Oh, look here, I've never paid before."
"Dare say not, dearie. We're full up tonight, so it's 10 bob. Anyone who comes after you will have to pay a quid. You're lucky."
"Let me speak to Mrs. Mayfield."
"I'm Mrs. Mayfield. 10 bob each."
"Why, Ma, I didn't recognise you in your finery. You know me, don't you? Boy Mulcaster."
"Yes, ducky. 10 bob each."
We paid, and the man who had been standing between us and the inner door now made way for us. Inside it was hot and crowded, for the Old Hundredth was then at the height of its success. We found a table and ordered a bottle. The waiter took payment before he opened it.
"Where's Effie tonight?" asked Mulcaster.
"Effie who?"
"Effie, one of the girls who's always here, the pretty dark one."
"There's lots of girls work here. Some of them's dark, some of them's fair. You might call some of them pretty. Haven't the time to know them by name."
"I'll go and look for her," said Mulcaster.
While he was away, two girls stopped near our table and looked at us curiously.
"Come on," said one to the other. "We're wasting our time. They're only fairies."
Presently, Mulcaster returned in triumph with Effie, to whom, without its being ordered, the waiter immediately brought a plate of eggs and bacon. "First bite I've had all the evening," she said. "Only thing that's any good here is the breakfast. Makes you fair peckish hanging about."
"That's another 6 bob," said the waiter.
When her hunger was appeased, Effie dabbed her mouth and looked at us. "I've seen you here before, often, haven't I?" she said to me.
"I'm afraid not."
"But I've seen you," to Mulcaster.
"Well, I should rather hope so. You haven't forgotten our little evening in September."
"No, darling, of course not. You were the boy in the guards who cut your toe, weren't you? Now, Effie, don't be a tease. No, that was another night, wasn't it? I know. You were with Bunty the time the police were in, and we all hid in the place they keep the dustbins."
"Effie loves pulling my leg, don't you, Effie? She's annoyed with me for staying away so long, aren't you?"
"Whatever you say, I know I have seen you before somewhere."
Soon she and Mulcaster were deep in conversation. Sebastian leaned back and said to me, "I'm going to ask that pair to join us."
The two unattached women who had considered us earlier were again circling towards us. Sebastian smiled and rose to greet them. Soon they, too, were eating heartily. One had the face of a skull, the other of a sickly child. The death's head seemed destined for me.
"How about a little party?" she said. "Just the 6 of us, over at my place."
"Certainly," said Sebastian.
"We thought you were fairies when you came in."
"That was our extreme youth," death's head giggled.
"You're a good sport," she said. "You're very sweet, really," said the sickly child. "I might just tell Mrs. Mayfield we're going out."
It was still early, not long after midnight, when we regained the pavement. The commissionaire tried to persuade us to take a taxi.
"I'll look after your car, sir. I wouldn't drive yourself, sir, really, I wouldn't."
But Sebastian took the wheel, and the two women sat one on the other beside him, to show him the way. Effie and Mulcaster and I sat in the back. I think we cheered a little as we drove off. We did not drive far. We turned into Shaftesbury Avenue and were making for Piccadilly when we narrowly escaped a head-on collision with a taxi cab.
"For Christ's sake," said Effie, "look where you're going. Do you want to murder us all?"
"Careless fellow, that," said Sebastian.
"It isn't safe the way you're driving," said Death's Head.
"Besides, we ought to be on the other side of the road."
"So we should," said Sebastian, swinging abruptly across. "Here, stop, I'd sooner walk."
"Stop, certainly."
He put on the brakes and we came abruptly to a halt broadside across the road. Two policemen quickened their stride and approached us.
"Let me out of this," said Effie, and made her escape with a leap and a scamper.
The rest of us were caught.
"I'm sorry if I'm impeding the traffic, officer," said Sebastian with care. "But the lady insisted on my stopping for her to get out. She would take no denial. As you will have observed, she was pressed for time. A matter of nerves, you know."
"Let me talk to him," said Death's Head. "Be a sport, handsome. No one's seen anything but you. The boys don't mean any harm. I'll get them into a taxi and see them home quiet." The policemen looked us over deliberately, forming their own judgment. Even then, everything might have been well, had not Mulcaster joined in.
"Look here, my good man," he said. "There's no need for you to notice anything. We've just come from Ma Mayfield's. I reckon she pays you a nice retainer to keep your eyes shut. Well, you can keep them shut on us too, and you won't be the losers by it."
That resolved any doubts which the policeman may have felt. In a short time, we were in the cells. I remember little of the journey there, or the process of admission. Mulcaster, I think, protested vigorously and, when we were made to empty our pockets, accused his jailers of theft. Then we were locked in, and my first clear memory is of tiled walls with a lamp set high up under thick glass, a bunk, and a door, which had no handle on my side. Somewhere to the left of me, Sebastian and Mulcaster were raising Cain. Sebastian had been steady on his legs and fairly composed on the way to the station. Now, shut in, he seemed in a frenzy and was pounding the door and shouting, "Damn you, I'm not drunk! Open this door! I insist on seeing the doctor, I tell you, I'm not drunk!" While Mulcaster, beyond, cried, "My God, you'll pay for this! You're making a great mistake, I can tell you! Telephone the Home Secretary! Send for my solicitors! I will have habeas corpus!" Groans of protest rose from the other cells, where various tramps and pickpockets were trying to get some sleep.
"Oh, pipe down! Give a man some peace, can't you? Is this a blinking lock-up or a loony house?"
And the sergeant, going his rounds, admonished them through the grill.
"You'd be here all night if you don't sober up."
I sat on the bunk in low spirits and dozed a little. Presently the racket subsided and Sebastian called,
"I say, Charles, are you there?"
"Here I am,"
This is a hell of a business. Can't we get bail or something?
Mulcaster seemed to have fallen asleep.
I tell you the man, Rex Mottram, he'd be in his element here.
We had some difficulty in getting in touch with him. It was half an hour before the policeman in charge answered my bell. At last he consented, rather sceptically, to send a telephone message to the hotel where the ball was being held. There was another long delay, and then our prison doors were opened. Seeping through the squalid air of the police station, the sour smell of dirt and disinfectant, came the sweet, rich smoke of a Havana cigar, of two Havana cigars, for the sergeant in charge was smoking also. Rex stood in the charge room looking the embodiment, indeed the burlesque, of power and prosperity. He wore a fur-lined overcoat with broad astrakhan lapels and a silk hat. The police were deferential and eager to help.
"We had to do our duty," they said. "Took the young gentlemen into custody for their own protection."
Mulcaster looked crapulous and began a confused complaint that he had been denied legal representation and civil rights. Rex said,
"Better leave all the talking to me."
I was clear-headed now and watched and listened with fascination while Rex settled our business. He examined the charge sheets, spoke affably to the men who had made the arrest. With the slightest perceptible nuance, he opened the way for bribery and quickly covered it when he saw that things had now lasted too long and the knowledge had been too widely shared. He undertook to deliver us at the magistrate's court at 10 the next morning, and then led us away. His car was outside.
"It's no use discussing things tonight. Where are you sleeping?"
"Marches," said Sebastian.
"You'd better come to me. I can fix you up for tonight. Leave everything to me."
It was plain that he rejoiced in his efficiency. Next morning the display was even more impressive. I awoke with the startled and puzzled sense of being in a strange room, and in the first seconds of consciousness the memory of the evening before returned, first as though of a nightmare, then of reality. Rex's valet was unpacking a suitcase. On seeing me move, he went to the washhand stand and poured something from a bottle.
"I think I have everything from Marchmain House," he said. "Mr. Mottram sent round to Heppel's for this."
I took the draught and felt better. A man was there from Trumper's to shave us. Rex joined us at breakfast.
"It's important to make a good appearance at the court," he said. "Luckily, none of you look much the worse for wear."
After breakfast, the barrister arrived, and Rex delivered a summary of the case.
"Sebastian's in a jam," he said. "He's liable to anything up to 6 months' imprisonment for being drunk in charge of a car. You'll come up before Grigg, unfortunately. He takes rather a grim view of cases of this sort. All that will happen this morning is that we shall have to ask Sebastian to be held over for a week to prepare the defence. You two will plead guilty, say you're sorry, and pay your 5 bob 9. I'll see what can be done about squaring the evening papers. The Star may be difficult. Remember, the important thing is to keep out all mention of Marm Mayfield's. Luckily the tarts were sober and aren't being charged, but their names have been taken as witnesses. If we try and break down the police evidence, they'll be called. We've got to avoid that at all costs, so we shall have to swallow the police story whole and appeal to the magistrate's good nature, not to wreck a young man's career for a single boyish indiscretion. It'll work all right. We shall need a don to give evidence of good character. Julia tells me you have a tame one called Sam Grass. He'll do. Meanwhile, your story is simply that you came up from Oxford for a perfectly respectable dance, weren't used to wine, had too much, and lost the way driving home. After that, we shall have to see about fixing things with your authorities at Oxford."
"I told them to call my solicitors," said Mulcaster, "and they refused. They've put themselves hopelessly in the wrong, and I don't see why they should get away with it."
"For heaven's sake, don't start any kind of argument. Just plead guilty and pay up. Understand?"
Mulcaster grumbled, but submitted. Everything happened at court as Rex had predicted. At 10:30, we stood in Bow Street, Mulcaster and I free men, Sebastian bound over to appear in a week's time. Mulcaster had kept silent about his grievance. He and I were admonished and fined 5 shillings each and 15 shillings costs. Mulcaster was becoming rather irksome to us, and it was with relief that we heard his plea of other business in London. The barrister bustled off, and Sebastian and I were left alone and disconsolate.
"I suppose Mummy's got to hear about it," he said. "Damn, damn, damn. It's cold. I won't go home. I've nowhere to go. Let's just slip back to Oxford and wait for them to bother us."
The raffish habitués of the police court came and went, up and down the steps. Still we stood on the windy corner, undecided.
Why not get hold of Julia?
I might go abroad.
My dear Sebastian, you'll only be giving a talking to and find a few pounds.
Yes, but it's all the bother. Mummy and Bridie and all the family and the dons. I'd sooner go to prison. If I just slip away abroad, they can't get me back, can they? That's what people do when the police are after them. I know Mummy will make it seem she has to bear the whole brunt of the business.
Let's telephone Julia and get her to meet us somewhere and talk it over. We met at Gunter's in Berkeley Square. Julia, like most women then, wore a green hat pulled down to her eyes with a diamond arrow in it. She had a small dog under her arm, three quarters buried in the fur of her coat. She greeted us with an unusual show of interest.
"Well, you are a pair of pickles. I must say, you look remarkably well on it. The only time I got tight, I was paralysed all the next day. I do think you might have taken me with you. The ball was positively lethal, and I've always longed to go to the Old Hundredth. No one will ever take me. Is it heaven?"
"So you know all about that, too?"
"Rex telephoned me this morning and told me everything. What were your girlfriends like?"
"Don't be prurient," said Sebastian.
"Mine was like a skull."
"Mine was like a consumptive."
"Goodness!" It has clearly raised us in Julia's estimation that we had been out with women. To her, they were the point of interest.
"Does Mummy know?"
"Not about your skulls and consumptives. She knows you were in the clink, I told her. She was divine about it, of course. You know, anything Uncle Ned did was always perfect, and he got locked up once for taking a bear into one of Lloyd George's meetings. So she really feels quite human about the whole thing. She wants you both to lunch with her."
"Oh, God."
"The only trouble is the papers and the family. Have you got an awful family, Charles?"
"Only a father. He'll never hear about it."
"Ours are awful. Poor Mummy is in for a ghastly time with them. They'll be writing letters and paying visits of sympathy, and all the time, at the back of their minds, one half will be saying, 'That's what comes of bringing the boy up a Catholic,' and the other half will say, 'That's what comes of sending him to Eton instead of Stonyhurst. Poor Mummy can't get it right.'"
We lunched with Lady Marchmain. She accepted the whole thing with humorous resignation. Her only reproach was, "I can't think why you went off and stayed with Mr. Mottram. You might have come and told me about it first." "How am I going to explain it to all the family?" she asked. "They will be so shocked to find that they're more upset about it than I am. Do you know my sister-in-law, Fanny Roscommon? She has always thought I brought the children up badly. Now I am beginning to think she must be right." When we left, I said, "She couldn't have been more charming. What were you so worried about?"
"I can't explain," said Sebastian, miserably.
A week later, when Sebastian came up for trial, he was fined £10. The newspapers reported it with painful prominence, one of them under the ironic headline, "Marquis's son unused to wine." The magistrate said that it was only through the prompt action of the police that he was not up on a grave charge.
"It is purely by the good fortune that you do not bear the responsibility of a serious accident."
Mr. Samgrass gave evidence that Sebastian bore an irreproachable character and that a brilliant future at the university was in jeopardy. The papers took hold of this too.
"Model student's career at stake!"
But for Mr. Samgrass's evidence, said the magistrate, he would have been disposed to give an exemplary sentence. The law was the same for an Oxford undergraduate as for any young hooligan. Indeed, the better the home, the more shameful the offence. It was not only at Bow Street that Mr. Samgrass was of value. At Oxford he showed all the zeal and acumen which were Rex Mottram's in London. He interviewed the college authorities, the proctors, the vice-chancellor. He introduced Monsignor Bell to call on the Dean of Christchurch. He arranged for Lady Marchmain to talk to the Chancellor himself, and as a result of all this, the three of us were gated for the rest of the term. Hardcastle, for no clear reason, was again deprived of the use of his car, and the affair blew over. The most lasting penalty we suffered was our intimacy with Rex Mottram and Mr. Samgrass, but since Rex's life was in London, in a world of politics and high finance, and Mr. Samgrass's nearer to our own at Oxford, it was from him we suffered the more. For the rest of that term he haunted us. Now that we were gated, we could not spend our evenings together, and from 9 o'clock onwards were alone and at Mr. Samgrass's mercy. Hardly an evening seemed to pass, but he called on one or other of us. He spoke of our little escapade, as though he too had been in the cells and had that bond with us. Once I climbed out of college and Mr. Samgrass found me in Sebastian's room after the gate was shut. That, too, he made into a bond. It did not surprise me, therefore, when I arrived at Brideshead after Christmas, to find Mr. Samgrass, as though in wait for me, sitting alone before the fire in the room they called the Tapestry Hall.
"You find me in solitary possession," he said. And indeed he seemed to possess the hall and the sombre scenes of venery that hung round it, to possess the caryatids on either side of the fireplace, to possess me as he rose to take my hand and greet me like a host. "This morning," he continued, "we had a lawn meet of the Marchmain hounds, a deliciously archaic spectacle, and all our young friends are fox-hunting, even Sebastian, who you will not be surprised to hear looked remarkably elegant in his pink coat. Brideshead was impressive rather than elegant. He's joint master with a local figure of fun named Sir Walter Strickland Venables. I wish the two of them could be included in these rather humdrum tapestries. They would give a note of fantasy." Our hostess remained at home. Also, a convalescent Dominican who has read too much Maritain and too little Hegel. Sir Adrian Porson, of course, and two rather forbidding Magyar cousins. I have tried them in German and in French, but in neither tongue are they diverting. All these have now driven off to visit a neighbour. I have been spending a cosy afternoon before the fire with the incomparable Charles. Your arrival emboldens me to ring for some tea. How can I prepare you for the party? Alas, it breaks up tomorrow. Lady Julia departs to celebrate the New Year elsewhere and takes the beau monde with her. I shall miss the pretty little creatures about the house, particularly one Celia. She is the sister of our old companion in adversity, Boy Mulcaster, and wonderfully unlike him. She has a bird-like style of conversation, pecking away at the subject in a way I find most engaging, and a school monitor style of dress which I can only call saucy. I shall miss her, for I do not go tomorrow. Tomorrow I start work in earnest on our hostess's book, which, believe me, is a treasure house of period gems, pure, authentic, 1914. Tea was brought, and soon after it Sebastian returned. He had lost the hunt early, he said, and hacked home. The others were not long after him, having been fetched by car at the end of the day. Brideshead was absent. He had business at the kennels, and Cordelia had gone with him. The rest filled the hall, and were soon eating scrambled eggs and crumpets. And Mr. Samgrass, who had lunched at home and dozed all the afternoon before the fire, ate eggs and crumpets with them. Presently Lady Marchmain's party returned, and when, before we went upstairs to dress for dinner, he said, "Who's coming to chapel for the rosary?" And Sebastian and Julia said they must have their baths at once, Mr. Samgrass went with her and the friar. "I wish Mr. Samgrass would go," said Sebastian in his bath. "I'm sick of being grateful to him." In the course of the next fortnight, distaste for Mr. Samgrass came to be a little unspoken secret throughout the house. In his presence, Sir Adrian Porson's fine old eyes seemed to search a distant horizon, and his lips set in classic pessimism. Only the Hungarian cousins, who, mistaking the status of tutor, took him for an unusually privileged upper servant, were unaffected by his presence. Mr. Samgrass, Sir Adrian Porson, the Hungarians, the friar, Brideshead, Sebastian, Cordelia, were all who remained of the Christmas party. Religion predominated in the house, not only in its practices, the daily mass and rosary, morning and evening in the chapel, but in all its intercourse. "We must make a Catholic of Charles," Lady Marchmain said, and we had many little talks together during my visits when she delicately steered the subject into a holy quarter. After the first of these, Sebastian said, "Has Mummy been having one of her little talks with you? She's always doing it. I wish to hell she wouldn't." One was never summoned for a little talk, or consciously led to it. It merely happened. And when she wished to speak intimately, that one found oneself alone with her, if it was summer, in a secluded walk by the lakes or in a corner of the walled rose gardens. If it was winter, in her sitting room on the first floor. This room was all her own. She had taken it for herself and changed it, so that, entering, one seemed to be in another house. She had lowered the ceiling, and the elaborate cornice which, in one form or another, graced every room, was lost to view. The walls, one panelled in brocade, were stripped and washed blue, and spotted with innumerable little watercolours of fond association. The air was sweet with the fresh scent of flowers and musty potpourri. Her library, in soft leather covers, well-read works of poetry and piety, filled a small rosewood bookcase. The chimney-piece was covered with small personal treasures, an ivory Madonna, a plaster St. Joseph, posthumous miniatures of her three soldier brothers. When Sebastian and I lived alone at Brideshead during that brilliant August, we had kept out of his mother's room. Scraps of conversation came back to me with the memory of her room. I remember her saying, "When I was a girl, we were comparatively poor, but still richer than most of the world. And when I married, I became very rich. It used to worry me, and I thought it wrong to have so many beautiful things when others had nothing. Now I realize that it is possible for the rich to sin by coveting the privileges of the poor. The poor have always been the favorites of God and his saints, but I believe that it is one of the special achievements of grace to sanctify the whole of life, riches included. Wealth in pagan Rome was necessarily something cruel. It's not any more." I said something about a camel and the eye of a needle, and she rose happily to the point. "But of course," she said, "it's very unexpected for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. But the gospel is simply a catalogue of unexpected things. It's not to be expected that an ox and an ass should worship at the crib. Animals are always doing the oddest things in the lives of the saints. It's all part of the poetry, the Alice in Wonderland side of religion." But I was as untouched by her faith as I was by her charm, or rather, I was touched by both alike. I had no mind then for anything except Sebastian, and I saw him already as being threatened, though I did not yet know how black was the threat. His constant, despairing prayer was to be let alone. By the blue waters and rustling palms of his own mind, he was happy and harmless as a Polynesian. Only when the big ship dropped anchor beyond the coral reef, and the cutter beached in the lagoon, and up the slope that had never known the print of a boot, there trod the grim invasion of trader, administrator, missionary, and tourist, only then was it time to disinter the archaic weapons of the tribe and sound the drums in the hills, or, more easily, to turn from the sunlit door and lie alone in the darkness, where the impotent painted deities paraded the walls in vain, and cough his heart out among the rum bottles. And since Sebastian counted among the intruders his own conscience and all claims of human affection, his days in Arcadia were numbered. For in this, to me, tranquil time, Sebastian took fright. I knew him well in that mood of alertness and suspicion, like a deer suddenly lifting his head at the far notes of the hunt. I had seen him grow wary at the thought of his family or his religion. Now I found I, too, was suspect. He did not fail in love, but he lost his joy of it, for I was no longer part of his solitude. As my intimacy with his family grew, I became part of the world which he sought to escape. I became one of the bonds which held him. That was the part for which his mother, in all our little talks, was seeking to fit me. Everything was left unsaid. It was only dimly and at rare moments that I suspected what was afoot. Outwardly, Mr. Symgrass was the only enemy. For a fortnight, Sebastian and I remained at Brideshead, leading our own life. His brother was engaged in sport and estate management. Mr. Symgrass was at work in the library on Lady Marchmain's book. Sir Adrian Pawson demanded most of Lady Marchmain's time. We saw little of them except in the evenings. There was room under that wide roof for a wide variety of independent lives. After a fortnight, Sebastian said, "I can't stand Mr. Symgrass any more. Let's go to London." So he came to stay with me, and now began to use my home in preference to March's. My father liked him. "I think your friend very amusing," he said. "Ask him often." Then, back at Oxford, we took up again the life that seemed to be shrinking in the cold air. The sadness that had been strong in Sebastian the term before gave place to a kind of sullenness even towards me. He was sick at heart somewhere. I did not know how, and I grieved for him, unable to help. When he was gay now, it was usually because he was drunk, and when drunk he developed an obsession of mocking Mr. Symgrass. He composed a ditty of which the refrain was, "Green ass Symgrass, Symgrass green ass," sung to the tune of St. Mary's chime, and he would thus serenade him perhaps once a week under his windows. Mr. Symgrass was distinguished as being the first don to have a private telephone installed in his rooms. Sebastian, in his cups, used to ring him up and sing him this simple song. And all this Mr. Symgrass took in good part, as it is called, smiling obsequiously when we met, but with growing confidence, as though each outrage in some way strengthened his hold on Sebastian. It was during this term that I began to realize that Sebastian was a drunkard in quite a different sense to myself. I got drunk often, but through an excess of high spirits, in the love of the moment and the wish to prolong and enhance it. Sebastian drank to escape. As we together grew older and more serious, I drank less, he more. I found that sometimes after I had gone back to my college, he sat up late and alone, soaking. A succession of disasters came on him so swiftly and with such unexpected violence that it's hard to say when exactly I recognised that my friend was in deep trouble. I knew it well enough in the Easter vacation. Julia used to say, "Poor Sebastian, it's something chemical in him." That was the cant phrase of the time, derived from heaven knows what misconception of popular science. "There's something chemical between them" was used to explain the overmastering hate or love of any two people. It was the old concept of determinism in a new form. I do not believe there was anything chemical in my friend. The Easter party at Brideshead was a bitter time, culminating in a small but unforgettably painful incident. Sebastian got very drunk before dinner in his mother's house, and thus marked the beginning of a new epoch in his melancholy record, another stride in the flight from his family which brought him to ruin. It was at the end of the day when the large Easter party left Brideshead. It was called the Easter party, though in fact it began on the Tuesday of Easter week, for the flights all went into retreat at the guest house of a monastery from Maundy Thursday until Easter. This year Sebastian had said he would not go, but at the last moment had yielded, and came home in a state of acute depression from which I totally failed to raise him. He had been drinking very hard for a week, only I knew how hard, and drinking in a nervous, surreptitious way, totally unlike his old habit. During the party there was always a grog tray in the library, and Sebastian took to slipping in there at odd moments during the day without saying anything even to me. The house was largely deserted during the day. I was at work painting another panel in the little garden room in the colonnade. Sebastian complained of a cold, stayed in, and during all that time was never quite sober. He escaped attention by being silent. Now and then I noticed him attract curious glances, but most of the party knew him too slightly to see the change in him, while his own family were occupied each with their particular guests. When I remonstrated, he said, "I can't stand all these people about." But it was when they finally left and he had to face his family at close quarters that he broke down. The normal practice was for a cocktail tray to be brought into the drawing room at 6. We mixed our own drinks and the bottles were removed when we went to dress. Later, just before dinner, cocktails appeared again, this time handed round by the footman. Sebastian disappeared after tea. The light had gone, and I spent the next hour playing Mahjong with Cordelia. At 6 I was alone in the drawing room when he returned. He was frowning in a way I knew all too well, and when he spoke I recognised the drunken thickening in his voice. "Haven't they brought the cocktails yet?" He pulled clumsily at the bell rope. I said, "Where have you been?"
"Up with Nanny."
"I don't believe it. You've been drinking somewhere."
"I've been reading in my room. My cold's worse today."
When the tray arrived, he slopped gin and vermouth into a tumbler and carried it out of the room with him. I followed him upstairs, where he shut his bedroom door in my face and turned the key. I returned to the drawing room full of dismay and foreboding. The family assembled. Lady Marchmain said, "What's become of Sebastian?" "He's gone to lie down. His cold is worse." "Oh dear, I hope he isn't getting flu. I thought he had a feverish look once or twice lately. Is there anything he wants?" "No, he particularly asked not to be disturbed." I wondered whether I ought to speak to Brideshead, but that grim, rock-crystal mask forbade all confidence. Instead, on the way upstairs to dress, I told Julia. "Sebastian's drunk." "He can't be. He didn't even come for a cocktail." "He's been drinking in his room all the afternoon." "How very peculiar. What a bore he is. Will he be all right for dinner?"
"No."
"Well, you must deal with him. It's no business of mine. Does he often do this?"
"He has lately."
"How very boring." I tried Sebastian's door, found it locked, and hoped he was sleeping. But when I came back from my bath, I found him sitting in the chair before my fire. He was dressed for dinner, all but his shoes, but his tie was awry and his hair on end. He was very red in the face, and squinting slightly. He spoke indistinctly.
"Charles, what you said was quite true. Not with Nanny, and drinking whiskey up here. None in the library now party's gone. Now party's gone, and only Mummy, feeling rather drunk. I'd better have something on a tray up here, not dinner with Mummy."
"Go to bed," I told him. "I'll say your cold's worse."
"Much worse."
I took him to his room, which was next to mine, and tried to get him to bed. But he sat in front of his dressing table, squinting at himself in the glass, trying to remake his bow tie. On the writing table, by the fire, was a half-empty decanter of whiskey. I took it up, thinking he would not see, but he spun round from the mirror and said, "Put that down." Don't be an ass, Sebastian. You've had enough.
What the devil's it got to do with you? You're only a guest here. My guest. I drink what I want to in my own house.
He would have fought me for it at that moment. Very well, I said, putting the decanter back. Only for God's sake, keep out of sight.
Oh, mind your own business. Came here as my friend. Now you're spying on me for my mother, I know. Well, you can get out and tell her from me. I'll choose my friends and she her spies in future.
So I left him and went down to dinner. I've been into Sebastian, I said. His cold has come on rather badly. He's gone to bed and says he doesn't want anything. Poor Sebastian, said Lady Marchmain. He'd better have a glass of hot whiskey. I'll go and have a look at him.
Don't, Mummy, I'll go, said Julia, rising.
I'll go, said Cordelia, who was dining down that night for a treat to celebrate the departure of the guests. She was at the door and through it before anyone could stop her. Julia caught my eye and gave a tiny sad shrug. In a few minutes Cordelia was back, looking grave.
No, he doesn't seem to want anything, she said.
How was he?
Well, I don't know, but I think he's very drunk, she said.
Cordelia! Suddenly the child began to giggle.
Marquis's son, unused to wine, she quoted. Model student's career threatened.
Charles, is this true? Asked Lady Marchmain.
Yes. Then dinner was announced, and we went to the dining room, where the subject was not mentioned. When Brideshead and I were left alone, he said,
Did you say Sebastian was drunk?
Yes.
Extraordinary time to choose. Couldn't you stop him?
No.
No, said Brideshead. I don't suppose you could. I once saw my father drunk in this room. I wasn't more than about 10 at the time. You can't stop people if they want to get drunk. My mother couldn't stop my father, you know.
He spoke in his odd, impersonal way. The more I saw of this family, I reflected, the more singular I found them. I shall ask my mother to read to us tonight.
It was the custom, I learned later, always to ask Lady Marchmain to read aloud on evenings of family tension. She had a beautiful voice and great humour of expression. That night she read part of The Wisdom of Father Brown. Julia sat with a stool covered with manicure things and carefully revarnished her nails. Cordelia nursed Julia's Pekingese. Brideshead played Patience. I sat unoccupied, studying the pretty group they made and mourning my friend upstairs. But the horrors of that evening were not yet over. It was sometimes Lady Marchmain's practice, when the family were alone, to visit the chapel before going to bed. She had just closed her book and proposed going there when the door opened and Sebastian appeared. He was dressed as I had last seen him, but now, instead of being flushed, he was deathly pale.
"Come to apologise," he said.
"Sebastian, dear, do go back to your room," said Lady Marchmain. "We can talk about it in the morning."
"Not you. Come to apologise to Charles. I was bloody to him, and he's my guest. He's my guest and my only friend, and I was bloody to him."
A chill spread over us. I led him back to his room. His family went to their prayers. I noticed when we got upstairs that the decanter was now empty. "It's time you were in bed," I said. Sebastian began to weep.
"Why do you take their side against me? I knew you would if I let you meet them. Why do you spy on me?"
He said more than I can bear to remember, even at 20 years' distance. At last, I got him to sleep, and very sadly went to bed myself. Next morning, he came to my room very early, while the house still slept. He drew the curtains, and the sound of it woke me, to find him there fully dressed, smoking, with his back to me, looking out of the windows to where the long dawn shadows lay across the dew, and the first birds were chattering in the budding treetops. When I spoke, he turned a face which showed no ravages of the evening before, but was fresh and sullen as a disappointed child's. "Well," I said, "how do you feel?"
"Rather odd. I think perhaps I'm still a little drunk. I've just been down to the stables trying to get a car, but everything was locked. We're off."
He drank from the water bottle by my pillow, threw his cigarette from the window and lit another with hands which trembled like an old man's.
"Where are you going?"
"I don't know. London, I suppose. Can I come and stay with you?"
"Of course."
"Well, get dressed. They can send our luggage by train."
"We can't just go like this."
"We can't stay." He sat on the window seat, looking away from me, out of the window. Presently, he said, "There's smoke coming from some of the chimneys. They must have opened the stables now. Come on."
"I can't go," I said. "I must say goodbye to your mother."
"Sweet bulldog."
Well, I don't happen to like running away. And I couldn't care less, and I shall go on running away as far and as fast as I can. You can hatch up any plot you like with my mother, I shan't come back. That's how you talked last night. I know. I'm sorry, Charles, I told you I was still drunk. If it's any comfort to you, I absolutely detest myself. It's no comfort at all. Must be a little, I should have thought. Well, if you won't come, give my love to Nanny.
You're really going?
Of course.
Shall I see you in London?
Yes, I'm coming to stay with you.
He left me, but I did not sleep again. Nearly 2 hours later, a footman came with tea and bread and butter and set my clothes out for a new day. Later that morning, I sought Lady Marchmain. The wind had freshened and we stayed indoors. I sat near her before the fire in her room while she bent over her needlework and the budding creeper rattled on the window panes. I wish I had not seen him, she said. That was cruel. I do not mind the idea of his being drunk. It is a thing all men do when they are young. I am used to the idea of it. My brothers were wild at his age. What hurt last night was that there was nothing happy about him.
I know, I said. I've never seen him like that before.
And last night of all nights, when everyone had gone, and there were only yourselves here, you see, Charles, I look on you very much as one of ourselves. Sebastian loves you, when there was no need for him to make an effort to be gay, and he wasn't gay. I slept very little last night, and all the time I kept coming back to that one thing. He was so unhappy. It was impossible for me to explain to her what I only half understood myself. Even then I felt, she will learn it soon enough, perhaps she knows it now. It was horrible, I said, but please don't think that's his usual way. Mr. Samgrass told me he was drinking too much all last term. Yes, but not like that, never before. Then why now? Here, with us? All night I have been thinking and praying and wondering what I was to say to him, and now, this morning, he isn't here at all. That was cruel of him, leaving without a word. I don't want him to be ashamed. It's being ashamed that makes it all so wrong of him.
He's ashamed of being unhappy, I said.
Mr. Samgrass says he is noisy and high-spirited. I believe, she said, with a faint light of humour streaking the clouds, I believe you and he tease Mr. Samgrass rather. It's naughty of you. I'm very fond of Mr. Samgrass, and you should be too, after all he's done for you. But I think perhaps if I were your age, and a man, I might be just a little inclined to tease Mr. Samgrass myself. No, I don't mind that. But last night and this morning are something quite different. You see, it's all happened before.
I can only say I've seen him drunk often, and I've been drunk with him often, but last night was quite new to me.
Oh, I don't mean with Sebastian. I mean years ago. I've been through it all before with someone else whom I loved. Well, you must know what I mean. With his father. He used to be drunk in just that way. Someone told me he is not like that now. I pray God it's true, and thank God for it with all my heart if it is. But the running away, he ran away too, you know. It was as you said just now, he was ashamed of being unhappy. Both of them unhappy, ashamed, and running away. It's too pitiful. The men I grew up with...
And her great eyes moved from the embroidery to the three miniatures in the folding leather case on the chimney-piece.
We're not like that. I simply don't understand it. Do you, Charles?
Only very little.
And yet, Sebastian is fonder of you than any of us. You know, you've got to help him. I can't.
I have here compressed into a few sentences what, there, required many. Lady Marchmain was not diffuse, but she took hold of her subject in a feminine, flirtatious way, circling, approaching, retreating, feinting. She hovered over it like a butterfly. She played grandmother's steps with it, getting nearer the real point imperceptibly while one's back was turned, standing rooting when she was observed. The unhappiness, the running away, these made up her sorrow, and in her own way she exposed the whole of it before she was done. It was an hour before she had said all she meant to say. Then, as I rose to leave her, she added, as though in an afterthought, "I wonder, have you seen my brother's book?
It has just come out. I told her I had looked through it in Sebastian's room. I should like you to have a copy. May I give you one? They were three splendid men. Ned was the best of them. He was the last to be killed, and when the telegram came, as I knew it would come, I thought, now it's my son's turn to do what Ned can never do now. I was alone then. He was just going to Eton. If you read Ned's book, you'll understand. She had a copy lying ready on her bureau. I thought at the time, she planned this parting before ever I came in. Had she rehearsed all the interview? If things had gone differently, would she have put the book back in the drawer? She wrote her name and mine on the flyleaf, the date and place. I prayed for you too in the night, she said. I closed the door behind me, shutting out the bon dieuserie, the low ceiling, the chintz, the lambskin bindings, the views of Florence, the bowls of hyacinth and potpourri, the petit point, the intimate feminine modern world, and was back under the coved and coffered roof, the columns and entablature of the central hall, in the august masculine atmosphere of a better age. I was no fool. I was old enough to know that an attempt had been made to suborn me, and young enough to have found the experience agreeable. I did not see Julia that morning, but just as I was leaving, Cordelia ran to the door of the car and said, "Will you be seeing Sebastian? Please give him my special love. Will you remember my special love?" In the train to London, I read the book Lady Marchmain had given me. The frontispiece reproduced the photograph of a young man in grenadier uniform, and I saw plainly revealed there the origin of that grim mask, which, in Bride's Head, overlaid the gracious features of his father's family. This was a man of the woods and caves, a hunter, a judge of the tribal council, the repository of the harsh traditions of a people at war with their environment. There were other illustrations in the book, snapshots of the three brothers on holiday, and in each I traced the same archaic lines. And remembering Lady Marchmain, starry and delicate, I could find no likeness to her in these sombre men. She seldom appeared in the book. She was older than the eldest of them by 9 years, and had married and left home while they were schoolboys. Between her and them stood two other sisters. After the birth of the third daughter, there had been pilgrimages and pious benedictions in request for a son, for theirs was a wide property and an ancient name. Male heirs had come late, and when they came, in a profusion which at the time seemed to promise continuity to the line, which, in the tragic event, ended abruptly with them. The family history was typical of the Catholic squires of England. From Elizabeth's reign till Victoria's, they lived sequestered lives among their tenantry and kinsmen, sending their sons to school abroad, often marrying there, intermarrying, if not, with a score of families like themselves, debarred from all preferment and learning in those lost generations, lessons which could still be read in the lives of the last three men of the house. Mr. Samgrass's deft editorship had assembled and arranged a curiously homogeneous little body of writing. Poetry, letters, scraps of a journal, an unpublished essay or two, which all exhaled the same high-spirited, serious, chivalrous, otherworldly air, and the letters from their contemporaries, written after their death, in all varying degrees of articulateness, told the same tale of men who were, in all the full flood of academic and athletic success, of popularity and the promise of great rewards ahead, seen somehow as set apart from their fellows, garlanded victims devoted to the sacrifice. These men must die to make a world for Hooper. They were the aborigines, vermin by right of law, to be shot off at leisure so that things might be safe for the travelling salesman, with his polygonal pince-nez, his fat wet handshake, his grinning dentures. I wondered, as the train carried me farther and farther from Lady Marchmain, whether perhaps there was not on her, too, the same blaze, marking her and hers for destruction by other ways than war. Did she see a sign in the red centre of her cosy grate, and hear it in the rattle of creeper on the window-pane, this whisper of doom? Then I reached Paddington, and, returning home, found Sebastian there, and the sense of tragedy vanished, for he was gay and free as when I first met him. Cordelia sent you her special love. Did you have a little talk with Mummy?
Yes.
Have you gone over to her side?
The day before I would have said, there aren't two sides. That day I said, no, I'm with you. Sebastian contra mundum. And that was all the conversation we had on the subject, then or ever.
but the shadows were closing round Sebastian. We returned to Oxford, and once again the gillyflowers bloomed under my windows, and the chestnut lit the streets, and the warm stones strewed their flakes upon the cobble. But it was not as it had been. There was midwinter in Sebastian's heart. The weeks went by. We looked for lodgings for the coming term and found them in Merton Street, a secluded, expensive little house near the tennis court. Meeting Mr. Samgrass, whom we had seen less often of late, I told him of our choice. He was standing at the table in Blackwell's, where recent German books were displayed, setting aside a little heap of purchases. "You're sharing digs with Sebastian," he said. "So he is coming up next term?" "I suppose so. Why shouldn't he be?" "I don't know why. I somehow thought perhaps he wasn't. I'm always wrong about things like that. I like Merton Street." He showed me the books he was buying, which, since I knew no German, were of no interest to me. As I left him, he said, "Don't think me interfering, you know, but I shouldn't make any definite arrangement in Merton Street until you're sure." I told Sebastian of this conversation, and he said, "Yes, there's a plot on. Mummy wants me to go and live with Monsignor Bell." "Why didn't you tell me about it?" "Because I'm not going to live with Monsignor Bell." "I still think you might have told me. When did it start?" "Oh, it's been going on. Mummy's very clever, you know. She saw she'd failed with you. I expect it was the letter you wrote after reading Uncle Ned's book." I hardly said anything. "That was it. If you were going to be any help to her, you would have said a lot. Uncle Ned is the test, you know." But it seemed she had not quite despaired, for a few days later I got a note from her which said, "I shall be passing through Oxford on Tuesday and hope to see you and Sebastian. I would like to see you alone for 5 minutes before I see him. Is that too much to ask? I will come to your rooms at about 12. She came. She admired my rooms. "My brothers Simon and Ned were here, you know. Ned had rooms on the garden front. I wanted Sebastian to come here too, but my husband was at Christchurch, and as you know, he took charge of Sebastian's education." She admired my drawings. "Everyone loves your paintings in the garden room. We shall never forgive you if you don't finish them." Finally, she came to her point. "I expect you've guessed already what I have come to ask. Quite simply, is Sebastian drinking too much this term?" I had guessed. I answered, "If he were, I shouldn't answer. As it is, I can say no." She said, "I believe you. Thank God." And we went together to luncheon at Christchurch. That night, Sebastian had his third disaster, and was found by the junior dean at 1 o'clock, wandering round Tom Quad, hopelessly drunk. I had left him morose but completely sober at a few minutes before 12. In the succeeding hour he had drunk half a bottle of whisky alone. He did not remember much about it when he came to tell me next morning. "Have you been doing that a lot?" I asked. "Drinking by yourself after I've gone?" "About twice. Perhaps four times. It's only when they start bothering me. I'd be all right if only they'd leave me alone." "They won't now," I said.
"I know."
We both knew that this was a crisis. I had no love for Sebastian that morning. He needed it, but I had none to give. "Really," I said, "if you're going to embark on a solitary bout of drinking every time you see a member of your family, it's perfectly hopeless."
"Oh, yes," said Sebastian with great sadness. "I know. It's hopeless."
But my pride was stung because I had been made to look a liar and I could not respond to his need. "Well, what do you propose to do?"
"I shan't do anything. They'll do it all."
And I let him go without comfort. Then the machinery began to move again. I saw it all repeated as it had happened in December. Mr. Samgrass and Monsignor Bell saw the Dean of Christchurch. Brideshead came up for a night. The heavy wheels stirred and the small wheels spun. Everyone was exceedingly sorry for Lady Marchmain, whose brother's name stood in letters of gold on the war memorial, whose brother's memory was fresh in many breasts. She came to see me, and again I must reduce to a few words a conversation which took us from Holywell to the parks, through Mesopotamia, and over the ferry to North Oxford, where she was staying the night with a houseful of nuns who were in some way under her protection. "You must believe," I said, "that when I told you Sebastian was not drinking, I was telling you the truth as I knew it." "I know you wish to be a good friend to him." "That's not what I mean. I believed what I told you. I still believe it to some extent. I believe he has been drunk two or three times before, not more." "It's no good, Charles," she said. "All you can mean is that you have not as much influence or knowledge of him as I thought.
It is no good either of us trying to believe him. I've known drunkards before. One of the most terrible things about them is their deceit. Love of truth is the first thing that goes. After that happy luncheon together, when you left, he was so sweet to me, just as he used to be as a little boy, and I agreed to all he wanted. You know I had been doubtful about his sharing rooms with you. I know you'll understand me when I say that. You know that we are all fond of you, apart from your being Sebastian's friend. We should miss you so much if you ever stopped coming to stay with us. But I want Sebastian to have all sorts of friends, not just one. Monsignor Bell tells me he never mixes with the other Catholics, never goes to the Newman, very rarely goes to Mass, even. Heaven forbid that he should only know Catholics, but he must know some. It needs a very strong faith to stand entirely alone, and Sebastian's isn't strong. But I was so happy at luncheon on Tuesday that I gave up all my objections. I went round with him and saw the rooms you had chosen. They are charming. And we decided on some furniture you could have from London to make them nicer. And then, on the very night after I had seen him, no, Charles, it is not in the logic of the thing. As she said it, I thought, that's a phrase she's picked up from one of her intellectual hangers-on. Well, I said, have you a remedy? The college are being extraordinarily kind. They say they will not send him down, provided he goes to live with Monsignor Bell. It's not a thing I could have suggested myself, but it was the Monsignor's own idea. He specially sent a message to you to say how welcome you would always be. There's not room for you actually in the old palace, but I dare say you wouldn't want that yourself. Lady Marchmain, if you want to make him a drunkard, that's the way to do it. Don't you see that any idea of his being watched would be fatal? Oh dear, it's no good trying to explain. Protestants always think Catholics, priests are spies. I don't mean that. I tried to explain, but made a poor business of it. He must feel free. But he's been free, always, up till now. And look at the result. We had reached the ferry. We had reached a deadlock. With scarcely another word, I saw her to the convent, then took the bus back to Carfax. Sebastian was in my rooms, waiting for me. "I'm going to cable to Papa," he said. "He won't let them force me into this priest's house." "But if they make it a condition of your coming up?" "I shan't come up. Can you imagine me serving Mass twice a week, helping at tea parties for shy Catholic freshmen, dining with the visiting lecturer at the Newman, drinking a glass of port when we have guests, with Monsignor Bell's eye on me to see I don't get too much, being explained when I was out of the room as the rather embarrassing local inebriate who's being taken in because his mother is so charming." "I told her it wouldn't do," I said. "Shall we get really drunk tonight?" "It's the one time it could do no conceivable harm," I said.
"Contramundum?"
"Contramundum."
"Bless you, Charles. There aren't many evenings left to us."
And that night, the first time for many weeks, we got deliriously drunk together. I saw him to the gate as all the bells were striking midnight and reeled back to my rooms under a starry heaven which swam dizzily among the towers, and fell asleep in my clothes as I had not done for a year. Next day, Lady Marchmain left Oxford, taking Sebastian with her. Brideshead and I went to his rooms to sort out what he would have sent on and what leave behind. Brideshead was as grave and impersonal as ever. "It's a pity Sebastian doesn't know Monsignor Bell better," he said. "He'd find him a charming man to live with. I was there my last year. My mother believes Sebastian is a confirmed drunkard. Is he?" "He's in danger of becoming one." "I believe God prefers drunkards to a lot of respectable people." "For God's sake," I said, for I was near to tears that morning, "why bring God into everything?" "I'm sorry, I forgot. But you know, that's an extremely funny question." "Is it?" "To me, not to you." "No, not to me. It seems to me that without your religion, Sebastian would have had the chance to be a happy and healthy man." "It's arguable," said Brideshead. "Do you think he will need this elephant's foot again?" That evening I went across the quad to visit Collins.
He was alone with his texts, working by the failing light at his open window. "Hello," he said. "Come in. I haven't seen you all the term. I'm afraid I've nothing to offer you. Why have you deserted the smart set?"
"I'm the loneliest man in Oxford," I said. "Sebastian Flight's been sent down."
Presently I asked him what he was doing in the long vacation. He told me.
It sounded excruciatingly dull.
Then I asked him if he'd got digs for next term. "Yes," he told me, "rather far out, but very comfortable. He was sharing with Tynegate, the secretary of the College Essay Society." "There's one room we haven't filled yet. Barker was coming, but he feels, now he's standing for President of the Union, he ought to be nearer in."
It was in both our minds that perhaps I might take that room.
"Where are you going?"
"I was going to Merton Street with Sebastian Flight. That's no use now."
Still, neither of us made the suggestion, and the moment passed. When I left, he said, "I hope you find someone for Merton Street."
And I said, "I hope you find someone for the Iffley Road." And I never spoke to him again.
There was only 10 days of term to go. I had got through them somehow and returned to London as I had done in such different circumstances the year before, with no plans made.
"That very good-looking friend of yours," asked my father.
"Is he not with you?"
"No." "I quite thought he had taken this over as his home.
I'm sorry, I liked him."
"Father, do you particularly want me to take my degree?"
"I want you to? Good gracious, why should I want such a thing?
No use to me."
"Not much use to you either, as far as I've seen."
"That's exactly what I've been thinking. I thought it perhaps was rather a waste of time going back to Oxford."
Until then, my father had taken only a limited interest in what I was saying. Now he put down his book, took off his spectacles, and looked at me hard.
"You've been sent down," he said. "My brother warned me of this."
"No, I've not."
"Well then, what's all the talk about?" he asked testily, resuming his spectacles, searching for his place on the page. "Everyone stays up at least 3 years. I knew one man who took 7 to get a pass degree in theology."
I only thought that if I was not going to take up one of the professions where a degree is necessary, it might be best to start now on what I intend doing. I intend to be a painter.
But to this my father made no answer at the time.
The idea, however, seemed to take root in his mind. By the time we spoke of the matter again, it was firmly established.
"When you're a painter," he said at Sunday luncheon, "you'll need a studio."
"Yes."
"Well, there isn't a studio here. There isn't even a room you could use decently as a studio. I'm not going to have you painting in the gallery."
"No, I never meant to."
"Nor will I have undraped models all over the house, nor critics with their horrible jargon, and I don't like the smell of turpentine. I presume you intend to do the thing thoroughly and use oil paint."
My father belonged to a generation which divided painters into the serious and the amateur, according as they used oil or water.
"I don't suppose I should do much painting the first year. Anyway, I should be working at a school."
"Abroad?" asked my father hopefully.
"There are some excellent schools abroad, I believe."
It was all happening rather faster than I intended.
"Abroad or here, I should have to look round first."
"Look round abroad," he said.
"Then you agree to my leaving Oxford?"
"Agree? Agree? My dear boy, you're 22.
20, I said. 21 in October.
"Is that all? It seems much longer."
A letter from Lady Marchmain completes this episode.
"My dear Charles," she wrote, "Sebastian left me this morning to join his father abroad. Before he went, I asked him if he had written to you. He said no, so I must write, though I can hardly hope to say in a letter what I could not say on our last walk. But you must not be left in silence. The college has sent Sebastian down for a term only, and will take him back after Christmas on condition he goes to live with Monsignor Bell. It is for him to decide. Meanwhile, Mr. Samgrass has very kindly consented to take charge of him. As soon as his visit to his father is over, Mr. Samgrass will pick him up and they will go together to the Levant, where Mr. Samgrass has long been anxious to investigate a number of Orthodox monasteries. He hopes this may be a new interest for Sebastian. Sebastian's stay here has not been happy. When they come home at Christmas, I know Sebastian will want to see you, and so shall we all. I hope your arrangements for next term have not been too much upset and that everything will go well with you. Yours sincerely, Teresa Marchmain."
I went to the garden room this morning and was so very sorry.